No repealing, no replacing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, July 18th. Good to have you with us. So looks like after months, actually years of trying, there's going to be no replacing or repealing Obamacare, at least not now. President Trump said his plan today is to just let Obamacare fail. You might expect health insurance companies have been holding their breath, waiting to see what's next. And to an extent, yes. But turns out many of the larger insurers don't make much of their money selling insurance in the individual market. Look at United Health. It's largely out of the exchanges. Today, it announced huge second quarter earnings, beating Wall Street expectations. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein checks it out.
When it came to selling Obamacare plans, United Health was the first major insurer to tap out. But Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Jason McGorman says apart from the ACA, the company actually loves government work.
Government-sponsored plans are the biggest driver of their revenue and their earnings growth.
It's about two-thirds of the company's revenue. United Health, along with Humana, Aetna, and Anthem, are all heavily invested in two lines of lucrative government insurance work. Some make nice money running Medicaid programs for states. And then there's Medicare Advantage, more comprehensive coverage managed by private insurers.
It's been a very good deal for many years.
Veteran affairs economist Austin Fracht.
If you're a health insurer and you're looking for where you want to grow your business, I think it is definitely a place where they've done well and they could continue to do well.
One big reason insurers see dollar signs in the senior market, the exploding number of baby boomers. Medicare, Medicaid, and even big data are all ways companies are making money. But Tom Policelli, the head of the insurer Minuteman Health, says in one way, they're missing out.
The traditional where your revenue and where your earnings came from tended to be smaller employers and individuals. That is not the case now. The case now, what you do is you gravitate away from that as much as you can.
Policelli says that's a waste. You've got more than 20 million people looking for coverage and insurers wanting to offer that coverage. All it's going to take, he says, is Congress to come up with some fixes. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Fizzled out healthcare reform pushed the dollar to an 11-month low today. Investors are doubting we'll see any of Trump's big promises realized anytime soon. Things like tax reform, a massive infrastructure package. But a gridlock DC isn't the only reason the dollar's weak. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Last year, the dollar was on a tear. It had been strengthening against other currencies for about a year and a half. Then in December, just after the election of President Trump, it hit a high. Robert Whitelaw teaches finance at NYU.
People perceive the U.S. economy as the most desirable place to invest.
He says the confidence came from an expectation that Trump's agenda was pro-business and anti-regulation, great for growth. But William Poole, who ran the St. Louis Fed for 10 years, says that agenda now seems stalled.
There's a huge amount of dysfunction in Washington, which makes it more difficult to figure out what's likely to happen.
And he says that uncertainty led to investors selling their dollars. Those stumbles on domestic policy have another consequence.
They affect possible course of Federal Reserve action.
The Fed isn't likely to bump up rates aggressively while there's no clarity on key domestic policies. Michael Farr, who runs an investment management firm in Washington, says globalization has made a difference, too. Economic improvements in parts of Asia and Europe can quickly draw more investors into those currencies and away from the dollar.
More and more world economic powers are running like the three-legged race with our sort of ankles tied together. We're now going to see that one really crosses the finish line much before the other.
Of course, a weaker dollar isn't all bad. U.S. manufacturers benefit because their exports are cheaper overseas, though it also pushes up prices domestically. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a mixed bag. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's no secret the Trump administration is a fan of fossil fuel dominance. key to the argument is the idea that renewable energy is unreliable, that if coal-fired electricity keeps shrinking, the lights could one day just go out. President Trump has suggested this, as have the heads of the EPA and the Department of Energy. Energy Secretary Rick Perry tasked his team with studying the question of grid reliability. They had about 2 months to report back, which is a blink in government time. A draft of that report has reportedly been leaked. The keyword here is draft. For more, Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk joins me. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Adrian.
What did the Energy Department find? What's the study tell us?
The staff draft did not really find what the secretary appeared to be looking for. The draft said it's not so bad. Or to quote the document, the grid is in good shape. System resiliency continues to improve. So the question is, what's the final report going to say? Because it's due now.
So, but did they answer the basic question, as I understand it, which is the question this administration has about renewable energies? If clouds block the sun, if the wind stops blowing, as I understand it, there's a stated concern the system becomes more unstable as it depends more on renewable energy. What'd the study find?
It's a complicated answer, so come with me, Adrian, down the rabbit hole of the
of
power
course.
Grid for a moment. Right? The grid is not, as the Flintstones suggested to me growing up, some assembly line of stegosauruses behind the wall, right? It's a really complicated
thing. More stegosauruses.
Right. Sorry to break this news to you. I've been able to go on a couple tours of grid operators, and it's this giant engineering exercise in redundancy. There are backup plans for everything. What if this plant goes down? What if this transmission line goes down, or the wind doesn't blow, or the control room goes down? There's even a second control room. So let me play you a bit of sound from a visit last week to the folks who operate a part of the grid in the east, from Tennessee to New Jersey to Illinois. Stu Bressler is senior vice president of what's called the PJM Interconnection, and he was asked by reporters if more renewables and less coal harm reliability.
I don't think we've seen that. I think it's safe to say that from PJM's standpoint, we haven't seen a degradation in reliability at this point, but we need to make sure we stay ahead of it. We did this analysis on the basis of retirement of all the coal and nuclear on the system and all of it being replaced by natural gas. We would run a reliable system.
Scott, though, he's talking about natural gas there. And I wonder what we know about wind and solar reliability.
That's been tested in the country. So in the southwest U.S., the wind power provided 52% of electricity in the system in February. It was not a problem. In Secretary Perry's home state of Texas, wind provided 48% of electricity at one point last year, not a problem. In New England, coal power is almost gone from the system, and that's of no concern. Now, these are declarations by the grid geeks. These are the reliability police telling us that.
So it sounds like the study certainly doesn't back up the administration's claim that we need more coal. What happens now?
First of all, this is a draft. And it can always change when the political appointees get their hands on it. That happens with any administration. They could massage it to argue for coal subsidies. They could try to undo state policies on renewable energy, as Secretary Perry has suggested. And rhetorically, this allows fossil fuel proponents to keep asking the question, are renewables bad for the system? To many, this is kind of an old question that's been answered. But here in Washington, you know, old questions have a way of developing constituencies, and they get backed by money. And they never go away.
Marketplace's Scott Tong. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Realtors in Harlem started calling the southern part of the neighborhood Soha. Southern Harlem, Soha. Anyway, residents have bristled at the new name, the rebrand. But it turns out the practice of renaming areas is common. Many communities see it as a way to help speed up economic development. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
We got our kitchen there and the servers, cooks. We got a big walk-in freezer back up in there.
Ron Smothers owns a Denny's restaurant at the corner of Crenshaw and Coliseum in South Los Angeles. Smothers has owned restaurants here since the late 70s, back when the area was still known as South Central.
South Central, when anyone said South Central, you knew what they were talking about. It was not a good place.
During the 1980s and 90s, Smothers said South Central had become synonymous for riots, gangs, and crime. So in 2003, the city council voted to rename the 16-square-mile district as South Los Angeles. Since then, demand for property has created all kinds of new development.
I think it was done with the realization that it would only help, because South Central had become an ugly word. Like I say, it hasn't hurt. If anything, I'd have to say it helped contribute to the progress we're seeing.
Across the country, what can it hurt wasn't the attitude some New Yorkers felt when references to SoHa or South Harlem started turning up on businesses and awnings.
I mean, I'm a real estate broker and I understand it. It's to make the place seem hip, different. You know, it's not Harlem, it's SoHa. It's really cool.
Danny Tyson was the first to notice when Keller Williams, a national real estate brokerage, began using SoHa, a name many locals feel is a slap in the face. Cordell Clear spoke out at a protest last month.
To come now, yesterday, and rename our community, where do they get off at? Where do they get off at? It is disrespectful to us.
Critics claim these rebranding campaigns are actually a backdoor way to raise rents and push out current residents. State Senator Brian Benjamin introduced legislation barring the renaming of neighborhoods without community input.
You know, we're happy to have newcomers, but not at the expense of those who have been here before. And so we've got to figure that out.
Benjamin says it's insulting to impose a new identity on folks who've lived here for generations without their input, especially in a place as culturally significant as Harlem.
And you want to preserve that. You don't want where Malcolm X used to give some of his most famous speeches and rallies on 116th Street to be renamed SoHa. You want it to be Harlem.
Benjamin notes that Harlem's gentrifying fast enough, even without rebranding. In other cities, however, a new name does mean a new neighborhood. Take, for instance, NoMa in Washington, D.C.
It's the area north of Massachusetts Avenue. That's what it stands for.
Robin Eve Jasper is the president of the NoMa Business Improvement District, an area which just 5 years ago was an industrial no man's land.
There was almost nothing here but a few derelict warehouses, mostly not in use, and just vacant lots.
5 years and billions of dollars later, NoMa is now home to 7,000 people and a booming market for apartments and office space. While the name does sound a bit trendy, Jasper likes it better than the original idea, Capitol Hill North.
It was authentic to where the neighborhood was. There wasn't something that was being obliterated in order to pick up that identity, and it was better than being fake Capitol Hill.
Jasper concedes that the success of NoMa has pushed up prices in surrounding neighborhoods, something the city's trying to address through mixed-income zoning. But whether you're talking about NoMa, SoHa, or some other acronym, the placemaking trend isn't slowing down, and some names will stick, others won't. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Coming up?
I just fell in love with it. Like, I was like, this is a perfect dish. I want to bring this to L.A.
Nashville hot chicken. I'm lucky I can still talk. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 54 points, a quarter percent, to finish at 21,574. The Nasdaq added 29 points, 0.4%, to end at 6,344. And the S&P 500 added just 1 point, barely changing, to end at 2,460. Not binge viewing, but binge trading today. Netflix announced it's now got more than 100 million subscribers glued to screens around the world. That made investors sit up and take notice. The company's shares jumped 13.5%. Ever feel like jumping on a Harley Davidson and heading off into the sunset? Seems fewer of us are feeling that urge. The company forecasts slowing shipments as baby boomer fans get older. That put the brakes on its share price, throttling down 5.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Today marks the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's death. To mark the occasion, the Bank of England unveiled a new £10 note with the image of Austen on the front. It's a fitting tribute. Austen wrote about love, marriage, but she also had a keen interest in money. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has our story.
These doors date from 1500.
Tour guide Yvonne Fernley addresses a group of devotees who come to pay homage to a secular saint.
May I welcome you to Winchester Cathedral. And we're both privileged, I think, and humbled because we have her here.
For two centuries, Jane Austen has lain in a grave under the cathedral floor, not quite undisturbed.
I have to tell you, she was moved. 1950s, they put the central heating in. The main pipe comes down the north aisle, and they had to just move her over a little bit. But she's nice and warm in the winter.
The author might have relished the irony of that posthumous slight, but how would she feel about appearing on a £10 bill? Catherine Sutherland, Professor of Literature at Oxford University.
I think she would be very amused by it. A woman who, throughout her writing life, was concerned with the profit she was making. I think she would be both proud and amused to find herself on a banknote.
Sutherland has curated an Austen exhibition here at Oxford's Bodleian Library. It sheds light on the many different facets of the writer's character, not least as the unmarried daughter of an impoverished clergyman on her personal fixation with money.
You might want to look at Jane Austen, as it were, the material girl, as she is living her life in London. This is a silk pelisse.
One of the exhibits here, a silk overcoat that cost Austen almost 20% of her annual earnings.
So, you know, it's a sizable amount of her money, and she was splashing out on a garment, and I think it's her saying, you know, I've arrived. I'm somebody.
Anyone that's read her novels or seen the movies will recognise, along with the elegant Regency interiors, that blatant emphasis on cash. Take Mrs. Bennet's exulting over the income of her daughter's new fiancé.
Exceed their income? What are you talking about? Don't you know he has 5,000 a year?
All the male suitors in Pride and Prejudice come with a price tag attached. Mr. Darcy, for example, commands £10,000 a year. Mary Guyatt, manager of the Jane Austen House Museum, concedes that money is a dominant theme.
Social status and income, you know, appears in all the novels.
It all sounds a bit mercenary now.
Well, of course, Jane was making a comment on the fact that women relied upon making a good marriage for their economic security.
Jane herself accepted an offer of marriage and of economic security from a wealthy neighbour, Harris Bigwither, but on reflection she backed out, deciding not to become Mrs. Bigwither after all. Professor Sutherland.
She then begins writing in earnest and sends off her first novel to a publisher. So I think she does see that as a moment when she's, as it were, made her choice, and her choice is to try to make money from her novels.
She didn't really succeed. She made in total no more than $25,000 in today's money. But she did write her way into the hearts, and now that her image will appear on the new bill, into the wallets of millions. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I stopped by Howlin' Ray's here in downtown Los Angeles. The year-old Nashville-style hot chicken spot has launched a bit of an obsession in this city. The chicken's fried, covered in enough cayenne pepper to make your eyes water. Lines stretch for hours, even during weekdays. Chef and owner Johnny Zone says he discovered the dish in Nashville, studied it, created his own version, and then brought it back here. First as a food truck, and now from a small storefront in Chinatown.
Yeah, so we're at Howlin' Ray's here in Chinatown in the Far East Plaza.
We serve Nashville hot chicken here to the masses, 11 to 4, Wednesday through Sunday.
We're at about 10, 15 right now, and you guys have hundreds of orders? What's going on?
Yeah, so we do, in order to kind of alleviate some of the stress on the line, we noticed in the beginning when we first opened that the big orders would really kind of chalk up the line and make the line a little bit longer. So we started doing some of the bigger orders in the mornings. You can book it out. It's about a month and out right now to book an order.
Whoa, if I want to order Howlin' Rays for my workplace a month from now?
Yeah.
Can you give it to me?
Yeah, and it's for 10 or more. That's kind of like the minimum requirement on it. Like we're cooking for the Dodgers today for 40 Sandos for them.
Wow.
And like, you know, like we do pretty larger orders. It's gone past 10 people, you know, on the pre-orders.
So you've got a month-long wait for group orders. You've got a line out here that's growing, and again, it's only 10:30. What explains, do you think, the popularity of this, of what you're doing?
I don't know. I think it kind of just caught on. And I also think there's an opening in the market in the sense of a really high quality fried chicken. And in terms of like normal restaurant rules, we're not really following those. Like,
what do you mean?
Obviously, there's no storefront to the street, right? We're only open 5 hours a day. Our food costs are a little bit higher than normal. We are closed 2 days a week.
How are you confident enough to open a restaurant breaking all those rules? I mean, there's got to have been a moment where you're like, should we really be closed for 2 days? Should we really only be open for 5 hours a day?
So I named this business after my dad who passed away. His name is Ray Zone. He did 3D comic books and stuff like that. And when that happened, it kind of was like one of those moments, right? Where it's like, you know, like, screw it. I'm going to just... I opened this with credit cards and a loan for my wife's car.
Wow.
Unsecured. So the cool thing about unsecured loans is you could use that money for other things. And so I kind of was just like, I want to do this. We could have extended the hours, and that was the plan. But because so many people kind of just kept showing up and orders just kept rolling in, we were unable to expand the current operation without more space.
Right.
So that's what we're working on next is we're taking over next door and expanding the space so that we can open another day and more hours.
Why hot chicken? Like, why Nashville hot chicken? Why was that the passion?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been a chef for 12 years, so I was cooking French food. I was a butcher for Nobu Matsuhisa, just butchering fish in the morning, and worked for Thomas Keller and Gordon Ramsay as well. So a lot of, like, French background and stuff. But when I had hot chicken in Nashville, I was doing a stage over at Sean Bock's place, Husk. And that's how we say hi. I just fell in love with it. Like, I was like, this is a perfect dish. I want to bring this to L.A. I felt like there's not a lot of people, not a lot of opportunities in life where you can say, I'm going to bring something to Los Angeles.
I hear there's another Nashville hot chicken shop that's opened up nearby. How's that affected you guys? Has it?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, when you're doing something at this level, you can take things in stride. So it's like, yeah, we there's a Nashville hot chicken spot that opened up pretty close. There's another one that opened up in Hollywood, and then another one, I think, in Orange County.
You know you're doing something, right?
Yeah, but honestly, like, it's awesome that there's so much love for hot chicken, and I'm so confident in our product and our team. If they get inspiration from us and they want to open up something similar, or like when we see on their Instagram, like they played it exactly how we played it, that's awesome. That means we're doing something right and we're ahead of the curve. And in fact, we actually promote those restaurants.
Why promote them?
Why promote them? Because LA is full of people who are quick to hate. And the restaurant industry is too hard. So you want to be supportive of people doing something they're passionate about, even if it stems from, you know, something you're doing. Don't be a hater, you know, like, support people.
And by the way, on the way out, it was about 10 minutes or so before the doors opened. The line of people waiting was wrapped around the plaza. We were able to try some of the chicken back at the office, including their hottest flavor, the Howlin' flavor. And this is what it sounded like.
It gets really...
Yeah, we've got the whole thing on our website, just to embarrass me, I think. That's marketplace.org. the super hot chicken eating happened a few days ago. Otherwise, I think I would still be sputtering through this broadcast. One final note before we go today. The case of the missing cheddar cheese. Sounds like a forgotten Nancy Drew title, but nope, this is real life. Two prize-winning blocks of cheddar cheese were stolen from a cheese show in Somerset, England. 88 pounds of cheese. The retail value is more than $1,000. That's a lot of cheddar. And I quote The Guardian here, "It is possible that could be worth much more if the right wealthy cheese-loving customers were found." So if any of you listening are approached by a high-end cheese dealer about some ultra-rare cheddar, be wary. Very wary. Today, the Dow was down 54 points, a quarter percent. The NASDAQ added 29 points, 0.4%. And the S&P 500 added just 1 point, barely changing. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you all here tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.